And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that takes me out of the studio and into the study where I have these laid-back conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, inspirational people, well, on the planet. And today is no exception. Today I have an opportunity to talk to J. Warner Wallace. But before I get to that, I want to remind all of you listening in to Hank Unplugged that you have a great part to play. What you can do is go to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating, and that ensures that this podcast reaches the ears of people in places that you will probably never visit. Also, you can share the podcast with others and continue making a difference in that way as well. Well, J. Warner Wallace is an incredible individual. He's a cold case homicide detective. He's a popular national speaker. He's now a best-selling author as well. And he continues to consult on cold case investigations, all the while serving as senior fellow at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview. And what's interesting about J. Warner is that he was a very vocal atheist until he was 35 years of age. Sort of reminds me of myself. I was a practical atheist as well until I was 29. But then he started taking a serious and expansive look at the evidence for the Christian worldview, and he determined that Christianity was not just true, but demonstrably true. J. Warner is now an author of such books as Cold Case Christianity, God's Crime Scene, Forensic Faith, and he has received some national recognition for the work that he has done as a professional investigator on NBC's Dateline, on Court TV, on Fox News. And I think very significantly for this broadcast and some of the questions that I want to ask him on the podcast is he was awarded the Police and Fire Medal of Valor, Sustained Superiority Award, and this for his continuing work on cold case homicides and the Cops West Award after solving a 1979 murder. J. Warner Wallace, as always, a welcome guest on the Bible Answer Man broadcast, and for the first time ever on the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hi, Jim.
So glad to be with you. I think you know how much you mean to me and my own journey out of atheism, so I'm just glad to be part of anything you're doing.
Well, I remember you telling that story on the Bible Answer Man broadcast, and quite frankly, I was stunned to hear that you were doing investigative work. You were, investigating robberies or something like that, sitting in your police car listening to the Bible Answer Man broadcast.
Yeah, you know, I was actually working undercover at the time I became a Christian, and it's a 4-year assignment. Basically, what we're doing is we are in a plainclothes position in undercover cars. My hair was really long. I think I had a beard or a goatee at the time, and we were following bank robbers or anybody who was doing crimes in our city. We would get an idea. Someone would say, "I think it's so and so," and we would go find so and so, and then we would sit on him for a week and see if he did anything. And sure enough, most of the time the informants were right. And so I was sitting in a surveillance position. And I was in a car maybe 10, 12 hours a day. You know, just wherever the bad guy goes, that's where we have to go. And he doesn't know we're following him. And so that's where I was when I first tuned into your show. And I was just struggling to figure out, you know, was there anybody else out there who took a reasonable evidential approach, could answer the questions, not just from a position of, well, I believe it, so therefore it's true, but could actually give me good reasons to why this was true. And that's when I found your show. And I was, you know, listen, that was at 3:00 every day, 5 days a week on KKLA in Los Angeles. And I remember just making sure wherever I was, hopefully nothing was happening at 3:00. And I could sit and listen for that whole hour. And it became a regular part of my intellectual diet. And that's why I think it's such an important, it plays such a huge role for me, both in terms of information, But honestly, Hank, it was just in terms of example. In other words, that there was somebody out there who took an approach that I could resonate with. And that was, because I didn't know anybody like that in my personal life. The Christians that I knew were not very thoughtful about why they were Christians, if I'm honest with you. And so I found somebody in you, and on the radio every day, it was just great.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm wondering what it was like for you, or what it is like for you as someone who was so involved in police work, to see people like Colin Kaepernick wearing socks that display police officers as pigs. I mean, this stereotypical idea that people have that police officers are racist, they're brutal, they're people of low character. How does that square with what you knew?
Well, I can tell you that this is a topic that is very near and dear to my heart, because I came out of the arts before. I was an illustrator and a designer, and then an architect before I became a police officer. So that's a very different world. But my father was a police officer my entire life, and so I knew the work and I was familiar with the work. And now, my son is doing the same work with the same name at the same agency. So we've been there for almost 58 years doing this work, and I have seen the progression over time. And I will tell you that there's some takeaways I have on this, because I do think we are at a point right now in culture where we are utterly divided over this issue of police and race. And there's something that you and I as Christians could actually do about it. But we'd have to be able to bridge the gap that divides us. And so that, to me, offers an analogy that we can move forward with. It's about crossing a bridge toward each other. Yes, there will be people on both sides who will point fingers and make outrageous claims about both sides. But that's not where I'm going to be, because I will tell you this. We've got reason. Law enforcement has a number of examples over the last 5 or 6 years that have been captured on video in which law enforcement officers are caught doing something they shouldn't do. That's just the way it is. But we've got to be able to deal with that in a way that's intellectual and rational. And they don't necessarily, I would argue, that they do not represent any of the majority. In fact, they are a dramatically small minority in this work. But I'll tell you this, no one is more upset about bad police behavior than good cops. No one's more upset about it. You think that the other side's upset? You kidding? I mean, cops who see this are the ones who are the most upset, because we don't want our good name sullied when someone occasionally does something they shouldn't do. Now, I will say this. Every time you engage someone in the field as a police officer, you have a dilemma you face, especially if it's a critical situation where you're going to have to use force. And you don't want to. Nobody wants to use force. We try to keep those people out of law enforcement. But are there racists in law enforcement? Of course. There are racists in every single field. We put a pretty strong protocol in place that we hope sorts out people with racist tendencies, but people can lie, and then they sometimes get in. And so, yes, are there racist doctors? Yeah. Are there racist firemen? Yeah. Are there racist police officers? Yeah. What percentage do you think they are, though? Do we think we have a systemic problem? I don't think we have a systemic problem. I think there are bad apples in every barrel of apples, and we've got to figure out where the bad apples are. And then, of course, nobody hates the bad apple as much as the good apples. So we want that kind of thing purged, okay? There's no doubt about it. And that's the first step, I would say. But remember this, though, Hank. If we're going to cross a bridge, there are some rules and some truths about bridge crossing. And the most important rule about bridge crossing is that no one crosses a bridge without taking a step toward the middle. You think you can stay on the edge, wherever you are, and not? If you want to cross that bridge, you're going to have to step away from your position on that edge and toward the bridge and toward the other side. And both sides of this argument, if they want to cross a bridge toward each other, are going to have to take a step toward the middle, and that means you're going to have to leave something behind.
I love it. I love it. That is so well said. You're mentioning in that explanation that you're an illustrator, that you are involved in architectural work, that this is a proclivity. And as I look through your books, that's very, very obvious, because you do your own illustrations. Talk about how these illustrations help people who are trying to work through very significant apologetic issues, help them grasp the concept.
Yeah, I think we are a visual culture, and whether we like it or not, we have a new language that we speak, and it's been driven by that glowing rectangle at the end of our arms, you know, that cell phone, that smartphone. The smartphone has, for the most part, changed the way we do business. We are the next generation coming up, Gen Z. These are usually typically described by the number of different descriptors, but the one that always comes out in first place is that they are digital natives. We, you and I, are digital immigrants. We came to this late. We didn't have this growing up, but they were born in that country where there were already smartphones. There was already digital technology, and really what drives digital technology is visual. So if you were going to upgrade your phone, you're probably only upgrading it, not because you got a new phone that has a much better operating system. I can't tell the difference between the operating systems in my 7 as opposed to the 4 and the 5, or now my son's got a 10, an iPhone, and I can't tell the operating difference really in terms of the system. But what I do notice is the screen's different, and the size of the screen is different, and the resolution of the screen is different. Even though the sound is the same, it operates the same, why do we upgrade phones? Because of the screens. And this tells me that the primacy of visual media. As a matter of fact, this now, I think, has become a language that I call visualish. In other words, instead of speaking English to Gen Z, the next generation coming up, I'm determined to speak to them visually, which means that when I start crafting an idea for a message or an idea for a book, I don't craft it with words. I sit down with Photoshop, usually, and sit down with all the possibilities visually, and I start to think, well, okay, it's about we're going to cross this bridge toward each other. Okay, so let's talk about the bridge as an analogy, because that's a very visual analogy. And then I can start thinking about how that's going to pan out in terms of language. So it's not that the language drives the visual, it's that the visual drives the language, and that's what I think we're seeing in Gen Z. As a matter of fact, that is now the largest group in the country. They outnumber boomers, they outnumber Gen X, they outnumber millennials. That is the language that the largest demographic in our country is being raised on. If we want to communicate to them, we're going to have to figure out a way to become visual. And look, a book is not visual. A book is words. And so, of course, I've got lots of words in my books, but I'm trying to also marry those to visual illustrations so that people can, and listen, I'm not saying it's good or bad, but the truth of it is that we have a shorter attention span. And we have a much shorter attention span. It used to be for millennials about 11 seconds. For Gen Z, it's around 8. Now, I want you to think about that for a minute. Doesn't mean they won't watch a 3-hour movie. They will. But back, if you look back at, say, something like Gone with the Wind, and there's a conversation between the two major characters in Gone with the Wind, well, the camera stays on one person until they're done with their sentence, and then it goes to the other person until they're done with their sentence. That's not the way we make movies now. Now we're shooting it from every angle. You'll have, you know, 4 or 5 seconds with him starting his sentence, then a view from over her shoulder, then a view from just her responding. I mean, we shift the scene every 5 to 8 seconds, and we're doing that because we recognize that our attention spans are shorter. And if we're going to write for this generation, if we're going to communicate to this generation on video, we're going to have to embrace that reality and turn corners as soon as we can.
But didn't you yourself change? I mean, maybe you didn't, but a lot of people change. I know when I became a Christian, I developed this voracious appetite for learning. So when you embrace the Christian worldview, it seems to have an impact on your attention span as well.
No, I think you're right, but look at it this way. I had a very, very large, I mean, I was in the Word about 2 hours a day, this is, at least until I started seminary. It seemed like when I started seminary, it changed the way I was looking at the Bible, not necessarily in a good way. I mean, I wasn't just reading it for the passion of wanting to get in the Word. Now I have a paper due on Friday, so I was reading it for a different purpose, and I almost in some ways wish that wasn't the case. But I was like, I mean, like everyone who's probably a new Christian, I was over the top in love with the Word, and you're absolutely right. I was intense a couple hours a day. Now, but I'll tell you this, I wasn't in love with the Word necessarily in the Latin Vulgate. I was in love with the Word in the English translation that I had in my hands. It wasn't about love of the Word. It was about what language am I embracing in order to understand the Word. And my problem is now, this generation, the language is not just words. That's why I call it visualish, is that it's a language. And if you're going to go to a native country as a missionary, you're going to learn their language. And you know, at first, you're not going to be very good at it, but you're going to try your best because they don't understand English. And I think we're dealing with a generation now that speaks a different visual language, and we're going to have to at least put our toes in that language if we want to reach them.
You know, I've often said that the issue of origins is not just a apologetic issue, it is the apologetic issue. How one views their origins ultimately is going to determine how they want to live their life. If you think you're a function of random chance that you arose from the primordial slime, you're going to live your life by a different standard than if you know you're created in the image of God and accountable to Him. And in that vein of thinking, I want to just talk about one of your books, God's Crime Scene, subtitled A Cold Case Detective Examines the Evidence for a Divinely Created Universe. The first thing I want to ask you about this is, what is a cold case detective?
Okay, so there's only, nationally, in our country, there's only one kind of crime that doesn't close after a set number of years. So if you do a robbery in our state, I'm sure it's true there for you as well, you spend a lot of time living right by me here in South Orange County. So in our state, if you do a robbery, it depends on what kind of crime it is. If it's a robbery, a theft, if it's a burglary, or whatever kind of crime it is, all of these have a period after which they would close automatically by statute. It's 3, 5, 7 years. They're going to close. You cannot go back and prosecute somebody, 15 years later for a robbery. That's got a statute of limitations, and it's already closed. Now, the only thing that doesn't have a statute of limitations are murders. So when we talk about cold cases, we're really only talking about one kind of crime. We're talking about unsolved murders, because there's no statute of limitations. Those stay open. They might be cold because no one's been able to find anything in years, but that's what I do, is I come back and I say, well, what's changed in the last 35 years that might give me a way in? What has changed that might give me a strategy, kind of looking at it from 30,000 feet, that maybe wasn't available right away? If you got 4 or 5 people who saw this thing and they were concerned about their safety because they were afraid this guy was going to hurt them, but now they're feeling pretty good about their safety, they might be willing to talk now when they weren't willing to talk before. So cold cases are simply unsolved murders.
And so you are solving the ultimate conundrum. I mean, is the universe created by an outside cause, by an uncaused first cause, or can the universe explain itself apart from an uncaused first cause?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, this little strategy I tried to illustrate in that book is one that I use at every death scene, because there's 4 ways to die, and not all those ways are criminal. You've got natural deaths, accidental deaths, suicides. Those are not things I investigate. I only investigate it when it's finally been ruled to be a homicide. So I have to figure out when I first get there, is this a natural, an accidental, or a suicide? Because if it is, I'm out. I'm not going to be investigating that. We don't investigate those kind of things. So the question really is, how do I determine if the death scene is a crime scene? And the strategy we always use, and although I did this for probably, 20 years before I started to think about it from 30,000 feet, is what we're trying to do here is we're saying, okay, can I explain everything that's in the room by staying in the room? If it's, there's a pistol next to the body, but that pistol is his pistol. He's only got one gunshot wound. It's his pistol, and there's a note next to his body written on his paper. I find it elsewhere in the room, and the doors are locked, and everything in the room comes back to him in terms of material evidence and DNA and fingerprints. Well, then I can explain everything in the room by staying in the room for an explanation. This is going to be an accidental or a suicide. But if I, on the other hand, have paper that's not his, and that's not his gun, it belongs to an unknown, and I have DNA and fingerprints that belong to an unknown who doesn't live there, and I even have footprints that lead out of the room, well, now the best explanation for the stuff that's in the room is a source that's outside the room. Everything now shifts toward homicide, because we have good reason to believe we have an intruder. Well, I thought, couldn't this be applied to the universe? Can I explain everything that's in the room of the natural universe by staying in the room? If so, I've got to explain everything with just space, time, matter, and physics and chemistry. That's it. That's all that's available to me inside the room. But I think there's a bunch of stuff in the room that you can't explain on just the basis of space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry. The better explanation is a cause outside the natural realm that's not spatial, not temporal, not material, all-powerful. These are the things that we have to have in order to explain what's in the room. And so I think we've got good reason to believe there's an intruder. And that's why, for me, as an atheist, I started thinking, well, a couple of things. Number one, why am I holding on? At the very least, I have to be a deist. At the very least. And then I'm asking myself, why would I suspect that if there's a personal God who is the creator of everything in the universe from nothing, why am I getting hung up over these small miracles in the New Testament? I mean, those are small potatoes, right? I mean, walking on water, this is the God who created everything from nothing. And so for me, it opened up the door for me to rethinking my view toward naturalism and then my view toward miracles that I was encountering in the New Testament.
What's really interesting is I was reading or rereading just the other day for something that I'm writing, The Atheist's Guide to Reality. That, of course, was written by the vaunted R. Taylor Cole, professor of the philosophy department at Duke University. He's the co-director of the Duke Center for Philosophy of Biology. I don't know if he still is, but certainly he was, and he's just written another book. Basically saying that history is unreliable. But at any rate, he says in his book, if I recall this correctly, 95% of the most distinguished scientists in America, along with, of course, their foreign associate members, they don't believe in God. And the other 5%, he says, simply swallowed the biggest conspiracy theory of them all, the story of how God put us here. And then he goes on to say something to the effect of science beats stories, stories about such things as meaning and purpose and free will and morality, stories we desperately need liberation from. And that seems to be a message that is not only catching on with his students at Duke, but with a whole variety of people around the world, but it has dramatic implications, because if you do not believe that there's a God, if you believe that there's no such thing as free will or morality or ethics or reliable history, you're going to live your life much, much differently than if you know there is a God and you're accountable to him.
I think what you said is very powerful, and I don't think a lot of people actually, I've heard you say this before, and I think you're spot on. Origins are the critical. Now I would have said as an atheist, and you probably would have too, when you were in your 20s, okay, great, this is the story, but again, this doesn't mean, okay, because it's practical and useful and helping guide us in the future does not mean it's true. And my dad would say as an atheist today, he's fine with me embracing this fairy tale if it has that practical application, that practical use in my life. He would say, I've lived my entire life, he's 78, I've lived my entire life without any need for that sense of false purpose. Now, I will tell you this. It's funny to me that anyone would write a book, and having written this classic atheist guide, right, he wrote that at some point in the past. But if we can't trust history, I can't even trust that he wrote that, I guess, right? I mean, it seems like it'd be a self-defeating proposition, because we can't even trust our own past, or the past of our families, and our stories about how we got here. So I think we have to trust some history. The question is, which history claims do we trust, and on what basis do we trust those claims? So I think that approach is faulty to begin with. But I think you're right about this idea of story. It's not as though science is not without its stories. Every model offered by scientists to explain the universe, or time, for example, the models that are offered, say, by Einstein, are really stories that help us to visualize the space, the time, the fabric of time. These are narratives that are parables, scientific parables of a sort, that help us to give us models, the same way I just provided for you this model of inside or outside the room. I'm telling a story about reality. Now, there are true stories, by the way. So, I mean, the story of reality is in Scripture. That's Greg Kochel's new book, The Story of Reality, a great book, by the way. There are true stories. So the only question is, yeah, we all use stories. We all use stories to accomplish a goal, to explain something that's difficult to an audience that maybe is having a hard time putting their hands around it. The only question is the story I'm telling a true story or a false story? And do you have a tool set in place that allows you to distinguish between the two? Look, I get guys all the time who come to me in criminal investigations, and they'll offer me a story. I got to figure out, are they lying to me? And so I have a set of tools in place that help me to understand the deception indicators, to understand these things that help me to know if they're telling me the truth. And this is the same thing we have to do when studying any claim about the past, including this guy's claims about the past and the present. I don't think they actually can. I mean, you like me, I'm sure you're writing this out in great. So we'll have a chance to kind of read it and see what you're thinking about it. But yeah, I have no problem with storytelling. If what you mean by storytelling is a way to communicate a difficult truth using a parable that helps you put your hands around it, we all tell those kinds of stories.
You talked about being an atheist. There's a new play on that word atheism. It's called apatheism. the new apathy about God, which says his existence is not considered even a relevant question. And it seems that this is maybe as dangerous as atheism in terms of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Some people call it the power of meh. But this apatheism, this apathy, how do you shake people out of their lethargy?
Well, I will tell you this. I'm writing a book right now with Sean McDowell on how to teach Christian apologetics to the Gen Z. And because we do a lot of this either at some worldview conference or in a classroom setting, we are about 70% of our audiences are young people. And I think that apathy is a far greater danger, is a far bigger hazard. I remember I had a prosecutor that I did most of my cold cases with. His name is John. And he had a co-prosecutor on several of our cases named Ethan. They would come over to my house to prep a case, and I'd be sitting for weeks with these two. Ethan and I would argue passionately. Ethan's a very adamant atheist, and we would get involved in an hour conversation at a time talking about theism, that, you know, God's existence. Meanwhile, John would get so upset, he would finally scream at Ethan and say, "Ethan, stop talking to Jim. He loves the fact that you're interested. You need to be more like me. Jim knows I couldn't care less about any of this stuff, so he doesn't talk to me about it. If you continue to show this kind of passion, he's going to be talking to you about this all day, and we're not going to get any work done." So he says, "Stop. You know, you need to be more like me." And he's absolutely right that it was difficult to talk to John about these issues, primarily because he was so his apathy was paralyzing. It's like, this is why. Well, who do we care? You know, it's like he loves sports, but if I was going to talk to him about some small division, you know, five team in some rural part of you know, Wisconsin, he doesn't care. It has no. Why should I care about that? And this is the way he saw the search for meaning in God. Why should I care about it? I think apathy and overcoming apathy is a key to what we're going to have to face in the next generation with Gen Z. And I think there are some strategies for this. Look, no one's apathetic at a point of crisis. I don't have to worry about apathy in my victim families, for example. They are all passionately engaged in the process. They want to see justice. It turns out that apathy is that thing that is kind of milling around until the rubber meets the road. And what we have to do is show our young people where and how the rubber meets the road. Where and how and why this is so critical. And a lot of that's going to come to them by way of narrative, by way of storytelling, by way of examples. And they love examples. They love storytelling. And so we're going to have to tell the stories that amplify for them why they should care. And they're probably going to be stories of tragedy, stories of crisis of meaning, a crisis of purpose. And I think when we do that, it's not really, we're not trying to falsely ignite a passion. We're simply trying to, this is where all apathy vanishes. It vanishes when someone finally steals your car. It vanishes when someone finally, on the basis of a worldview that you don't agree with, does something to harm you. This is where apathy vanishes. And so I think that in the end, we have to kind of help our, also, let's face it, if we aren't modeling energy, passion, interest, if we are not clearly passionate about what we believe, then good luck trying to transfer that to the people you're working with, to the young people you're leading. You know, it's one thing to say, "I don't understand why anyone doesn't come to youth group." Well, I'm going to be honest. I'm going to look and say, first, what does the leader look like? What is the leader passionate? Because passion is contagious. It's one of those things that is caught rather than taught. And I think that that's part of it, too. So I think there's several things we can do, but one of them is just I take, for example, I noticed when I would start with young people, and I would say, "Hey, in 8 weeks, we're going to go to the campus of UC Berkeley, because I want you to see what that campus is like, and I'm going to put you on the campus of Berkeley, so you're going to have to witness and talk to students, most of whom are not going to be Christians or not going to be religious. And I'll give you some strategies here, but we're going to train you for 8 weeks, but we're going to bring you up. We're also going to put you on the stage where you're going to have a chance to debate with atheist speakers and atheist thinkers." Suddenly, the apathy is like, they want to go on the trip to Berkeley because it sounds exciting, so they'll go. But I have never returned with an apathetic student, because putting them in that hot seat is what ignited their passion to do it again. And I also have never done a trip like that where it didn't grow every year. If you went the first year, you wanted to go every year. And so I had more and more students I'd be taking over the course of 4 or 5 years. Those kinds of trips put the rubber to the road, and that's where we see apathy go away.
What's interesting about this discussion is I did a podcast with John Dickerson. He wrote a book called The Great Evangelical Recession, Hope of Nations. Great guy, great author, great pastor. But he says of the 3.7 million U.S. evangelicals who are 18 to 29 years old, 2.6 million are going to leave the faith at some point between their 18th and their 29th birthdays. And even more alarming, as John points out, is the fact that the vast majority of them will never return. This seems to be a pressing problem, and many evangelical leaders, pastors included, priests, they are whistling as they walk past the graveyard. We have a declining church, a church that is not making disciples, and therefore, by definition, we have a dying church.
Yeah, that's something that's been, so I got saved back in the day I told you I was working undercover, and so right away I wanted to do everything I could to kind of catch up with those people I knew who were Christians before me, and so it wasn't long that I was finally enrolled in seminary. I came out with a degree in theology, and I right away started pastoring both at the elementary, then at junior high, then at high school level. My kids were growing up at this time, so I just kind of followed them along. And it bothered me because I saw even back then that most of our kids who would graduate and go to schools here on the West Coast that were hostile toward the Christian faith, like Berkeley, like Sonoma State, places like that, they came back without, they were no longer Christians. Now, I've been collecting the surveys done nationally since 1999. I have one article on our website, coldcasechristianity.com. This is the only one that has the word updated. So if you type in updated, you'll see it come up right away. It's updated all of the research on the departure of young people from Christianity. Here's what I've noticed. It's across the board. Every denomination suffers the same problem. And he's only talking about millennials, 18 to 30. You know, the Gen Z has already been polled. It is the least religious, the least interested in God of any of the groups in our nation, and it is the largest group in the nation. The future does not look bright. Now, what I've noticed is in the first early years, we were polling to see, well, how many of you are leaving? And that polling usually occurred in the early college years. So they poll out pretty bad, you know, 60, 50, 80, depending on the poll, percent will say they are no longer part of the church in any way. But then we started after maybe 5 or 6 years of this, of asking the question, well, why are you not here? And the largest group of answers that I've collected, all of them in which they gave open questions, you just give me why you're gone, it comes down to maybe 70 to 80% is just intellectual skepticism. Questions they thought were not answerable by Christianity, and people they thought they tried to get an answer from, and they did not answer them. Now, there's also a smaller group that's it's relational. You know, it's either hypocrisy they've seen, but it's nothing compared to the intellectual skepticism. When you ask them, that's what they're telling us. The third generation of surveys coming out in the last 2 or 3 years has really been about, well, okay, I get it, you're no longer a Christian. I get why you're no longer a Christian, but tell me, when do you think you really checked out? Because although I'm doing the poll when you're 20 or 21, I want to know, when did you first think this is not true? Because I think we thought that, yeah, people are going to college and they're leaving the faith. That's not what the polls show. The polls show that on an average, people leave the faith between the ages of 10 and 17. They're leaving while they're still with us, but they just aren't telling us. They'll continue to go to church, but they're no longer interested. And they're just going because, now, once they get away from us and they are in control of their own schedule, they stop going to church. But they had checked out years prior. And I think that's what all the studies show. And I've collected all those and placed them all on one location so people can see them. That's, by the way, downloadable as a PDF as well. My point in all of this, though, Hank, is to say that, yes, we have been whistling past this problem for a generation. And here's what I see. I kind of say, look, if the whole nation is a box, well, only about 70% of that box is still a Christian. It's been a couple of years since we did that survey. I bet you it's closer to 65%. So in that box called the nation, we've got a large pot that's about 65% of the box that those people are saying they are still Christians right now. That pot shrinks by about 1 or 2% a year. And that people who are in that pot are jumping out into the larger box, and they are not necessarily becoming atheists or agnostics. They will simply just say, I no longer have any affiliation with any belief system. I still might believe there's a God of some sort, but it's of my own making. So they're not affiliated. They check the box that says no affiliation or none. They're called the Rise of the Nuns. The nuns are growing by about 1% a year as Christianity is shrinking by about 1% a year, and every study is showing that. But interestingly, if you poll the people in the pot, that 65 to 70%, and you said, hey, what is Christianity? You can claim to be a Christian, but what does that even mean? Only about 20%, a cup that sits inside the pot, only about the size of that cup actually knows what Christianity teaches. The rest, it turns out, are just people who have been loosely affiliated with Christianity. They still identify as Christians, but they may or may not believe in any or affirm any of the teaching of Christianity, even morally or doctrinally. So that's the group that's shrinking. When we poll these three groups, we find that that cup is not shrinking. That 20% has been pretty stable. But the larger pot is shrinking by 1% a year. So we have, are we shrinking? We are and we kind of aren't. I mean, we are if in a sense we include everyone who's in the pot. But if the true church is what's in the cup, that seems to be pretty stable. And so I think that you'll see people who are divided on this issue about whether or not Christianity is shrinking. And that's the phenomena they're trying to describe. See, once again, we're using a story, or at least an analogy, to make the thing clearer. So I am concerned, but I am hopeful, because those 70%, that large pot, those folks are still reachable. And all of those who've jumped out of the pot into the box but have not yet said they're atheists, they're still reachable. We just have to do a better job of explaining this. And by the way, it cannot be, well, most people will tell you they're a Christian because they were raised in the church or because they've had some experience. That is not enough to make the case, because everyone of every belief system, if you're a Muslim, a Buddhist, whatever, the most popular answer in every religious system is, I was raised this way. And the second most popular answer in every religious system is, I've had a set of experiences that confirm it's true. Our answers cannot be the same as everyone else's answers unless we're willing to just be one of many possibilities that people might embrace. If we are the truth, our answer has to be uniquely Christian in its response. And we are the one religious worldview that makes a claim about history that is either verifiable or falsifiable. It's grounded evidentially in the past. We could make a case for Christianity in a way that's very different than the case for Buddhism or the case for Islam or the case for Jehovah's Witnesses or whatever it may be. Ours, we can make foundationally different, and we ought to start being able to do. That's why I'm so passionate about getting involved in this process, because, man, I wasn't raised in the church, and I still wonder why we do church the way we do it and why we live the way we do in church. I mean, I just have no context, right? I'm coming from a foreign planet to planet Earth, trying to figure out why these Christians are experiencing their faith this way. To me, it's about whether or not this is true, number one. And then once I know this is true, allowing God to work through my life, which I'll tell you is the hardest part. It's really easy to determine it's true. I mean, I can give you some strategies for that, but relinquishing your will, letting your guard out so you can now let God do the work he needs to do in your life, I mean, that's part of the sanctification process that's been the hardest for me. Compared to the actual investigation of the claims.
When you were talking, there were a number of things that were going through my mind. One is, when I grew up, I would ask questions. I grew up in a different circumstance than you did. I grew up in a Christian family. But my problem was, I was very inquisitive. I'd ask questions. I barraged my parents, my teachers. I went to a Christian school with questions, and I didn't get satisfying answers. And then I suppose I assumed there weren't satisfying answers, although there are a lot of qualifications I can make in that, you know, as I got older, I realized it wasn't that, and you alluded to this as well, it wasn't that I couldn't believe, it was that I wouldn't believe. That's one thing that was going through my mind. The other thing that was going through my mind is meaningful discussions, that so often in our culture, we don't have meaningful discussions or in-depth discussions anymore because people are preoccupied with toys or tools, like the phones that you mentioned. And the third thing that was going through my mind is this idea of being able to think, meaning that, you know, I watch a particular show every night because I find it intriguing. It has a debate quality to it. But what's frustrating to me is that the segments are so incredibly short. Then you go to commercial and you never really get to digest what's going on. You don't get to think about it. Someone's selling you soap. And then you go back to some other issue. And so you never really get an in-depth way of thinking about things. So, you know, we can have the sound bite. I can say to you, you know, what do you think about Colin Kaepernick? He's got pigs on his side. Well, in a discussion, you get a fuller concept. You start talking about the bridge and all this. So the one of the problems that you have here is that we no longer seem to have, in a soundbite society, the possibilities or the aptitude or even the appetite for thinking through very complex, substantial issues.
Boy, that's huge what you just said. So, yeah, this is why I don't try, when someone comes on Twitter and levels a complaint or has a question that they're, I have to kind of assess, are they serious? Are they really struggling with this issue? Or are they just trying to take a kind of quick hit at me and then off to the next thing? Because I do not engage people in 280 characters at a time. There's no point in that. You cannot do justice to the argument. If I think that there's something, I'll say direct message me, and then I'll assess his claim or assess where he is personally or she is personally, and then I'll decide if I want to get in an email exchange or even get on the phone with somebody, because I need to know, is this somebody who's really seeking an answer here or just somebody who wants to level a complaint? And I think that you're absolutely right, especially in the age in which we live now. We're going to have to be very careful about the platform under which we are willing to engage topics. So this is why social media is you'll see my social media is utterly apolitical, and it is utterly just about trying to advance the work of mostly others who are working in apologetics, because I try to follow about 700 apologetics blogs and post out whatever the best stuff is out there. But, I mean, I'm just trying to provide you, I'm trying to curate information for people who are interested. But in the end, it's relationships where the real work gets done. So we always talk about this, young people. Well, look, it's not going to be just about a truth claim. It's going to be a truth claim in the context of relationships. And this makes sense, right? Because God's holy nature is this perfect balance between mercy and justice, you know, grace and law. And so we have some truth claims, but they're not met without relationship. And this is what we have to do, I think, also personally with kids and with each other, is that it's hard for me to make these claims with somebody with whom I have no relationship. Far better if I cultivate it. That doesn't mean we're going to just stay with relationship evangelists. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is, if I've got to do my best, if I only have 2 hours, I've got to build, even when I've got a suspect in custody. Hank, for years ago, I did this. I was working with guys we would follow, and we'd watch them do a robbery or watch them do something terrible, and then we'd take them into custody right away, and we'd bring them into the office, and we had to do an interview. And I would tell my partner, dude, we're going to go and get some food, and we're going to bring that food back, and we're going to sit and we're going to eat with this guy. And my partner would say, you're crazy. No, I'll bring him some food. But I'll even bring it into his room there. He can have something to eat before we start talking to him. But I'm not eating with him. And I'm like, no, we're going to eat with him. Because there's something about a meal that develops relationship. And we're not going to be talking about anything other than whatever, you know, just try to relax during the meal. And think about it, that's crazy, right? You got a guy in custody who you're trying to get to confess to some terrible crime. And we're now going to spend time eating with him and trying to develop a relationship with him. Because in the end, I already saw him do the crime. This is done. He's going away. This is a slam dunk. But he's still a person who I want to reach. And he's still a person who has a life outside of his sentence. And he's going to come back out into the population at some point. I'm not looking just to punish him. I'm looking to help him transform his life. And that is done by way of relationships. And you start building those relationships from the moment you come in contact. So I'm far less likely, because of the nature of the social media platforms, I will not typically engage in those kinds of conversations solely by way of social media. I want to find a format, a template that allows me to develop a relationship a little better than that. That's a challenge for sure, but it's not undoable. It's just a matter of us saying, hey, not here. I'm not going to do this here.
You just mentioned your dad a little earlier on in the conversation. Kind of interested because my dad was a Christian. I came from a Christian home. When I became a practical atheist, there was a big separation between me and my dad that was healed as a result of my embracing Christ. In your case, it sounds like your dad is probably a great person, a great police officer. I think you mentioned he's 78 years of age now. What's it like for him if you're trying to put yourself in his shoes? Here you have become a Christian. You've written these great apologetic materials. You're talking about Christ in blogs. You're writing pieces for Fox. And what's it like for him? Has he got any interest in it, or is he pretty much resigned to the idea that I'm a good person, I've done a lot of good stuff during my life, I really don't need this God that you're writing books about?
Boy, that's a big question. And, you know, all of us probably have somebody on our mind right now that we think, if there's one person I'd like to reach, it would be that person. Well, that's my dad, for me. This is probably one of my best friends, if not my very best friend on planet Earth. So what do I do about it? You know, it's not as though I haven't made the case repeatedly. I have. It's not as though I didn't write a book to him. I wrote one of my books I wrote just to him. And I'm not even sure if he read past the foreword, you know, but I mean, you do your best, right? And certainly he knows what I believe, and he knows why I believe it. We've had these discussions, and he's got access to all my material as well. I don't think it's a matter of him saying, well, I'm a good person, and so I think it's a matter of him saying, there is no God. It doesn't matter if I'm a good person or not. There is no God to ultimately judge this. But I'll tell you this, he does love the fact that he lives in a country whose history and ethics were shaped by a Judeo-Christian foundation. He loves that. He thinks he does not want less Christians in America. He wants more. Doesn't think it's true, but he knows it works. It's practical. And so he is accepting of it that way. Now my hope is, and you know, and he was, as he's aging, he would say things to me like, "Hey, you know, someday I'll think about it. When I get close to the end, I'll give it some thought." I'm like, "Dude, you're close to the end right now, okay?" I mean, you know, what do you think you're going to have? Someone's going to call you and say it's tomorrow? Is this going to happen suddenly? You're not going to have a chance to think about it. You should probably think about it now. I've had those kinds of conversations with him, but I think for him, it's really a matter of will, not of you know. I always say there are three reasons why anyone rejects a truth claim, and I call these the three reasons why anyone shuns the truth. The first is rational. The second is emotional, and the third is volitional. And he is I think he's in a position of volition that he doesn't want to bend his knee to this. But I still trust God, and a lot of it for me is I'm not anxious about these kinds of issues, because if you'd have met me a month before I ever walked into the first church I walked into with my wife, because she drugged me there, and she wasn't even a Christian herself. But if you would have known me that month before, and people who did know me, they would say, "Jim Wallace, there's no way that guy is ever going to be a Christian." And I mean, they would have said that with such certainty. I would have said that with such certainty, yet here I am. So I know that God does what God does, and I'm just trusting the goodness of God. Not necessarily, look, if he doesn't bring my dad to faith, I'm not going to shake my fist at God. I think the cop in me is pretty even emotionally about these kinds of things. There's been people who I really, really liked, but I knew they killed their wife. And I had to take them to court, and I had to finish the case, even though, to be honest, I liked the guy. I wouldn't mind having him as my neighbor, but hey, 30 years ago, he did kill his wife. So I've been there with people I really like, who I know in the end, justice has to be served. And I have to be a part of it, and I know in the end here this would be something that I wouldn't want, but I'm trusting the claim that once we are in the presence of God, and our loved ones aren't there, we still will not have a tear. I'm trusting those promises of God, and at some point you have to trust the promises of God. I mean, you cannot. Like, you know, try to rationalize everything. At some point you say, okay, this is a system is true. Jesus rose from the dead. I have a tendency to believe people who rise from the dead. I believe the New Testament. I believe what's written in Scripture. I believe the promises of God. And so when it comes to this, I'm going to have to trust God for it. And even if he doesn't bring my dad into the kingdom, I know that there's some greater purpose that is served by him not doing so. And doesn't change my day to day. I see my dad a lot. As a matter of fact, we've been pitching a show to one of the networks based on three generations of Blue Bloods doing these investigations. And so my dad is still a very much an everyday part of my life. And I'm just hoping that God is shaping all of even that, because he's trying to reach my dad with the truth. And so we'll see.
One of the great things about your family is you know detective skills, and I like this part of your application to apologetics. It's not just about catching a fish for someone or presenting the arguments to someone, but actually teaching them the skills that are necessary to be an effective apologist.
Yeah, that's what was done for me. We all, have something we feel that God has gifted us with, or maybe given us an interest in a certain area over other areas. And that's been, you know, the teaching side of it has been one of the things that I have always been passionate about, is how do I get people to see this complex concept? How do I get a jury, when it's going to take 150 pieces of evidence, how do I get the jury to be able to connect all the dots and put the puzzle together and render a verdict? And that's a part of my nature to want to be able to take this complex thing and make it simple, so that jurors can, because, you know, let's face it, we get these expert witnesses, they come in and they testify in our cases, but they don't get a vote. In the end, if the jurors are not convinced, it's all for nothing. I might think this case is good based on my expertise, but the jurors are just, you know, they're people out of our culture that are smart and they're interested, but they don't have any expertise. I make sure they have no expertise related to the specifics of our case, because your pride will step in the way if you think you know something. So I'm always putting people on my juries that have no professional expertise in these lanes. You know, if it's a fire started by an electrical, you know, cross wiring, I'm not putting electricians. I'll have electricians testify, but I'm not putting electricians on my jury. So I think that all of us, when we're assessing the claims of historians, assessing the claims of astrophysicists, assessing the claims of microbiologists or biochemists, we don't have to have that level of understanding to be able to put our hands around it and render a verdict. Juries do this every day, and I do not put experts on my jury. So I think we have enough. We know enough to be able, that's what I'm trying to do in my work, is to communicate at a level that juries will say, yep, I number one, I agree. Number two, I want to act now. There's two things we're trying to do with juries. Number one, get them to agree with our side, our version of what happened. But we also don't want them to spend 3 days in the jury room trying to figure this out. We want them to agree quickly and want to pull the trigger now, want to say, let's go back right now and tell them where we got a verdict. Because the longer they spend in that jury room doesn't help the prosecution, okay? We want them in and out. So we're trying to do two things. One, convince them as true. Two, energize them to act now. Well, that's what I'm trying to do with the young people in my youth group, is I'm trying to get them to be energetic and act now. That's part of what we do.
One of the things I'm excited about in reading your books is you pay attention to mental evidence. I want you to explicate that a little bit. What does it mean, for example, to be able to explain the existence of God by pointing to the fact that we're not just material beings? There's a metaphysical aspect to our humanity, that the mind and the brain are not identical.
Yeah, that's a big one, right? Because if atheism is true, then we are in a naturalistic universe that is built on just three characteristics: space, time, matter. Space, that means everything in the universe is really material. And this idea of materialism or physicalism proposes that you might have a brain that's a physical thing. I could maybe make an argument on how your brain could be evolved through a physical process involving the laws of physics, the laws of chemistry, and somehow this could evolve over time. Fine. But then we get to this idea of mind. The mind is immaterial. So what about a physical process of evolution could ever produce this immaterial, non-physical thing called mind? And this is why we call this the problem of mind. How do we explain it? Does it exist? Some would say it doesn't exist. Some would say it's utterly an illusion that's created by the physical thing you have called a brain that gives us this illusion of consciousness, this illusion of mind. As a matter of fact, Sam Harris, the neuroscientist who's a philosopher of sorts, who also is an author, as an atheist, he denies the reality of mind. He thinks it's illusory. It's something that we sense only as a product, an illusion, a product of our brain activity. Now, here's the problem with that. There's another problem in terms of free will, because if you cannot act freely using your conscious mind, what's really happening is the predetermined sequence of physical events in your brain leads to an outcome. And that means your decision-making is truly not free the way you think it is. And you might think it's free, but what it really is based on prior neurons that fired, physical events that occurred in your brain that were dependent on even prior physical events over which you had no control, according to Sam Harris. So he not only denies mind, he denies the kind of free agency we all experience. That means, now I'll tell you this if for no other reason, we all have an experience of mind and an experience of free agency. And we know every day that we are encountering evidence of mind and evidence of free agency in our own interactions with people. We experience this. If you're going to argue that these two things are not actually true, well, then the evidence for your claim would have to be so incredibly high that it would surpass my own everyday eyewitness experience as a person who believes I have a mind and who acts freely as though I do have a mind. And the evidence has never been high enough to substantiate any other claim about what it is we're really experiencing. Our true experiences, I think, are still the best evidence we have. And here's the problem. If atheism is true, you're just a brain, and you don't make free choices. Yet we seem to have minds, and we're even thinking about this claim I just mentioned, using what, your brain? If so, then you've already decided if it's true or false based on prior events in your brain, and this thinking you're doing, you're not actually doing. Remember, without free agency, you're not going to be able to do a few things that require free agency. For example, love requires free agency. It cannot be compelled. It cannot be just another domino that falls in a series of physical events. We have to choose freely to love in order for love to have meaning. So first thing we'll have to get rid of is your notion of love. Also, creativity. You think you like the arts, you like to create. Well, you can't be creative if you don't get to make free choices. You can't also reason between two options that seem to be begging for a decision, because you can't make free decisions between rational options. So reason has to be redefined. And finally, you aren't culpable. You can't be held responsible for your eye color. That's just a consequence of your genetic physical nature of your body. Well, then if your thoughts are actually just a result of the physical structure of your brain, why would I hold you accountable for your thoughts or your actions for that matter? I mean, you have to give up and sacrifice a lot to think that we are simply physical, robotic meat machines in the universe. And I'm not willing to give those things up because my practical everyday experience says something else. And I think that we have to make a distinction between mind and brain. And I try to do that in the book, where I should give you reasons, ways in which the mind is clearly not like the brain. And of course, if they are the same thing, they would share all the same characteristics. They don't. And therefore, I think we've got good reason to reject this notion that we are simply brains in a meat robot that has gotten us here through evolutionary processes. If that was the case, how could we even be sure that the evolutionary process has landed us at a place where we are thinking rationally right now? For all we know, you wouldn't trust the thoughts of a Neanderthal if you believe in evolution. Why do you think that right now you should stop in time and trust your thoughts right now? Aren't we part of an evolutionary process? I mean, we should wait and see what the man says in 2,000 or 200,000 years, shouldn't we? Why would you think that your own thoughts are reliable if evolution is true? So I think a lot of this is just a matter of trying to help people to think clearly about the distinctions between matter and non-material entities like minds.
What is really interesting about what you just said is that you have people like the aforementioned Alex Rosenberg, who bites the bullet and says there is no such thing as free will. We're just a function of brain chemistry and genetics. That's the way it is. But I'm interested in probing a little bit on this subject, because I grew up in a Christian context in which there was a very pronounced kind of theistic fatalism. And what happened to me is when I saw the logical consequences of the idea that people are born who are doomed from the womb to certain destruction, I didn't want to have any part of that kind of Christianity. I mean, that had made a real big impact on me as a young boy. Well, then I become a practical atheist. I mean, I always had this drawback to Christ and Christianity, but from a practical standpoint, I lived as an atheist. And I realized all of a sudden, Jim, that, wow, I had just traded in one kind of fatalism for another. And so my question, I guess, and this is sort of a hot seat question, is how important do you think it is for Christians to have a robust understanding of free will?
Oh, okay. So, yeah, this is a question I get all the time on college campuses. As a matter of fact, a lot of atheists will say, well, look, as a Christian, you believe that everything is predestined by God. So you have the same problem that we would have as non-Christians in believing that we have this this predestined future based on the physical nature of the universe that begins with the Big Bang. all the way till now. Every domino has fallen a certain way, and there are no choices that are truly made. Well, you have the same problem, Mr. Christian, because you believe in a God who predestines everything. So I think what I would say to that is that, yeah, you know, there's a huge spectrum of Christian belief related to the sovereignty of God and the free actions of humans. And this is a debate that has been going on theologically with biblical support on both sides for many, many generations. Here's what I do know. I do know this. Given the two kinds of universes that are possible, one that is governed by physics and one that is governed by a creative being, the only version of the universe that could ever possibly allow for the freedom of free agents like you and me is not the one that's governed by physics. Because if that's the case, physics cannot say, I could control this, but I'm not going to. But a designer God could take that position. And now when and how he takes that position, that's open for debate. I get it. But of the two possible universes, only one allows the possibility of free agency, and it's not the atheistic universe governed by physics. It's the theistic universe governed by a divine being. Now, you're right. I mean, if you're going to ask me, well, how does that work exactly? Well, first of all, it has no chance to work under physics. But there is a chance for it to work over here. It'd really be up to the will of God and what God is trying to do. And there's lots of people who have tried to resolve that. I'm a compatibilist for the most part. I think that you're free, you're acting freely if you get to do what it is you want to do. But I think what we want to do, our base desires, is where the real decisions are really made. But I will say that regardless of how you land this conversation about free agency and sovereignty, what is the alternative under atheism? So I think we do have options as theists, but atheists don't.
Only a cold case detective, and a very skillful one at that, could have nuanced the answer so brilliantly. Great job.
Well, I appreciate you saying that.
Well, you know, and it kind of brings up something else I wanted to say, and that is, you know, from your perspective, all of us have to become effective Christian case makers. I mean, this is not just a nicety, this is a moral responsibility for all Christians. How do you drive home that point in the Christian community?
Oh, boy. You know, when I wrote Forensic Faith, I included a part of the chapter that I took out because Rice Brooks, who's a pastor in Tennessee, I sent the copy to him before I published it, and he said, dude, you need to take that out. And I'm like, make every pastor your enemy. And what it was that I noticed, I'll just tell you, now, against his better judgment, I'm going to tell you what I took out. I had a passage in there because what I discovered, you know, I'm a detective first, and even now I've got two open cases. I'm getting ready to go back and do some work as a detective.
But do you ever sleep?
Well, I do. Don't ask my wife though, because she she'll say I don't. But I think that, you know, I just try to spin a lot of plates, right? But I'll tell you this: I didn't expect to be traveling all over the country speaking. I just wrote this book because Sean McDowell and I were training kids and taking them to Berkeley, and I was training the students in Berkeley one trip, and he said, you should write a book about this. And that's how the first book got written. It was not really my intention to write books. But what I noticed is that after I started writing books, people would ask me to come to their church. And 4 or 5 years into it, I had a full calendar. And what I noticed going from church to church is that most of the time, if I'm honest with you, it wasn't the pastor who was asking me to come. It was usually a deacon or an elder or somebody in the church who had influence with the pastor. And after prodding that pastor for weeks and weeks and months, the pastor finally said, okay, fine, bring him. And so I get there and I realize that the first person I had to convince was the lead pastor, who didn't think there was really any need for any of this. And that's why I wrote Forensic Faith, was to make a case for making the case, because I knew that no one's going to read the books to make a case about God or a case about Christianity if they don't think first they need to make a case. And so we have to figure out how to cross that barrier first. I don't know. Because I had no footing in a Christian tradition, never set foot in a Christian church until I was 35, it helped me not to have the traditions guiding my decision-making. I just thought, okay, I don't know how everyone else becomes a Christian, but I know why I'm a Christian. And I thought everyone became a Christian like this. I put it this way. If you were an alien who was visiting our solar system for the first time and you're now approaching Earth and your adjutant says to you, hey, before we get there, a bunch of these folks, for example, in America are Christians. And if you want to know what they believe and who they are, I've got this book here called The Bible. Take a look at it and read it. So as an alien, I read through the entire Bible from front to from cover to cover in preparation to meet Christians who I'm about to meet on planet Earth, do you think that this alien coming in would be surprised at how it is Christians meet and how it is they express their faith in the traditions of the church, given all he has to figure out who Christians are is a text called the Bible? That's all he has, and he's trying to figure out what is he going to encounter. That was me at 35. I just knew I read the Bible, and I thought, okay, I don't know what Christianity is, but if it's this, okay, I'm willing to jump in. But I couldn't understand why what I was reading in Scripture didn't seem to be expressed robustly in the context of these congregations that I was part of. And I love the church. We need to love the church. The church is the church. You don't turn your back on the church. You might think you're in a church right now, and like, oh, I wish it was different. Really? Well, the reason why it's a mess is because people like you and me are in it. Okay, the dirty little humans mess up everything. So just love the church. Power through its deficiencies. The church is still the best answer that God has given us. And even the traditional church setting we have in America is still the best hope for the future. So I'm going to say that first. But I didn't understand why we were doing it this way. And when I encountered pastors who didn't seem to have... Look, in Scripture, it's clear that Jesus is an evidentialist. I'm sorry. He just is. I mean, if you look in the Gospel of John, he will repeatedly say, if you don't believe what I'm telling you, believe on the witnesses of John the Baptist, of the Father, believe on the indirect evidence of these miracles I'm working in front of you. He referred constantly to either other witnesses, or that's direct evidence, or to the miracles, that's indirect evidence. He referred constantly to those things to make his case. Even when John the Baptist was having issues, he's in custody, and he sends his disciples to Jesus, and his disciples say, hey, John sent us. He wants to know, are you the one? I'm thinking Jesus could basically have slapped those guys and said, really? Duh, I'm his cousin, okay? He leapt in the womb. He's the one he's asking me now if I'm the one? Is he crazy? You tell him to pray about this. You tell him to go and have more faith. He doesn't say any of those things. Instead, he says, stand by, and he does three miracles in front of John's disciples, and he says, go back and tell John what you just saw. That is an evidential approach to making a claim for who you are. He spends 40 days in Acts 1 after the resurrection making many convincing proofs. Really, that resurrection was not enough? Well, he spent 40 more days showing additional convincing proofs to his disciples and then commissioned them as what? As eyewitnesses. In fact, when Judas was replaced in the upper room, they replaced him with somebody who had to have been an eyewitness from the time of the baptism to the resurrection, and Matthias fit that category. He's using eyewitnesses to testify about what they saw. That's called direct evidence. Even if you said, no, I just trust what the Bible says, well, what are you trusting? You're trusting an allegedly reliable eyewitness account about, you're stuck with evidence no matter how you cut this pie. And I just thought, well, shouldn't everyone then be as interested as I am in the evidence? Well, it's not that way. And our job is to, and by the way, this is why I was so appreciative of what you were doing, and you've been doing it now for as long as I've been a Christian, longer, and that is something that you probably saw it was rare back then. It's equally rare now, and it's our job to. And by the way, what I think is happening in that pot in the box that's shrinking every year toward the size of the cup, I think people in the cup get it, and I think this just the people who are in the pot don't. And we need to spend time helping the people in the pot, because most of the people in the cup already get this.
We've sort of alluded to two of your books, God's Crime Scene, A Cold Case Detective Examines the Evidence for a Divinely Created Universe, and Forensic Faith, a book about making the case for the case. But one book we haven't touched on, and you sort of alluded to some of the details in this book, is Cold Case Christianity, where a homicide detective, obviously you, investigates the claims of the Gospels. And I find that fascinating as a subject matter in and of itself, because here you have the Synoptic Gospels, you have John, and so many people in our culture are saying, well, they colluded, they're all telling you the same thing, or some people say exactly the opposite of that, which is they're not giving you information that can be properly correlated. Then there are people that are saying, you know what? There are much, much better Gospels, but they got outed for some nefarious reasons, like the Gospel of Judas. I mean, that was a whole lot better than the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John is anti-Semitic. The Gospel of Judas wasn't anti-Semitic. That's why the Gospel of John actually got in, because at the time there were many anti-Semites. And so you have all these arguments going on, but if you actually read the Gospels, you find that they cohere brilliantly.
Yeah, I was never shaken as an early investigator. You know, I went out and bought a Bible because the pastor said that Jesus was the smartest man who ever lived. And he said, you know, all of our laws, he said, for example, are really written based on the Judeo-Christian foundation that comes straight from sermons of Jesus. I mean, you could go back to some of these sermons and go back to the Old Testament, Leviticus and Exodus, and you can find the roots of all of our laws. And I thought, is that true? You know, I'm a cop enforcing the law, and I didn't believe that to be true. So I went out and bought a Bible just to see if that was true. And when I first read through the Gospels, I didn't expect them to be what they are. Historical narratives, making claims about events that allegedly happened historically. And you've got a couple of these, like Matthew and John, which are coming from the lips, allegedly, of the actual eyewitness. And then you got people like Mark, who Papias says in the early second century, that was written at the feet of Peter. And you've got Luke, who says he's writing it based on his interviews of eyewitnesses. Okay, great. This is right in my realm, because I'm constantly looking at supplemental reports written 35 years ago, 40 years ago, about some eyewitness who now is dead. And even the guy who wrote the report is now dead. So now I've got to figure out, is this a true claim from 40 years ago? It's very similar to what we do in the Gospels. And so I was never shaken by the differences between the accounts, because I have worked crimes that could have occurred 2 hours ago. The only thing I ask people in dispatch, when dispatch sends me to a murder scene, the only question I've ever asked the dispatcher, and it's always the same, and on one or two occasions when I've forgotten to ask this, it's hurt me. And I'm, you know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, so I'm half asleep when they call. But I'll say, hey, tell the officers on the scene to separate the eyewitnesses. It's going to take me about an hour to get there, so just tell them right now. Go on the air and tell the officers to separate the eyewitnesses. That's the only request I have, because if you don't ask for that, when you get there, you'll get the same story 4 or 5 times. And that's not what eyewitnesses do. They bring different angles, and not just geographic angles, but philosophical angles, experiential angles. They bring different context to what they've seen, and I want all of it. Even if sometimes when I first get there, it's like, I don't even know how this could all be true, because these things seem to be contradictory. I still collect all of it, and I do not want them to talk to each other to make their to try to iron these details out. That's my job as the investigator. I'm supposed to do that. And if I get there and they've already ironed out the problems, then I'm missing data. So I want to see the apparently contradictory accounts. That is the one of the first things I trust as an indicator that I actually have a reliable account. So when I first started reading through the Gospels and I saw they varied, that's one of the things that piqued my interest, because I have recognized over the years the degree of variation I should expect. And when I read through the Gospels, I was like, oh, man, that degree of variation I would expect from reliable accounts, it seems to be pretty good. It's about what I would expect. And I thought, okay, well, this doesn't mean it's true. But I knew this, that the first thing you have to determine if an eyewitness is reliable was he really there? Is he making this whole thing up? Was he really there to see what he said he saw? So when I look at the Gospels, I'm only interested in the ones that are written within the lifetime of eyewitnesses. So the Gospel of Judas is just too late. It doesn't pass the first test. Why would I trust it over John when I can date John far earlier than I can date the Gospel of Judas? And so if there weren't Gospels that were dated as early as the 4 canonicals, I wouldn't trust anything written about Jesus. But I trust these because these are the ones that the very first, the students of the disciples, so Ignatius and Polycarp and Papias and Clement of Rome, these are the people, they were quoting these Gospels. They were relying on these Gospels because these are the 4 that were early enough to have been written by eyewitnesses. And you also have second century church leaders who are identifying the other late Gospels and calling them out as late Gospels. So I don't know why we would consider are there other things written about Jesus? Well, yeah, I should hope so, because let's face it. When a true thing happens, you have the eyewitness accounts, and then you have the ripple effect of the kind of legends that occur in culture as a result of what the eyewitnesses said. And that's what we're seeing with the non-canonicals. We're seeing all the ripple effect that we would expect to see if something this crazy, God coming in the form of a man, really occurred. I would expect to see more than just this little bullseye. I'd expect to see things in the nine ring. I'd expect to see things in the eight ring. I'd expect to see things in the seven ring on the target. And that's what I'm seeing here, is I'm seeing all those non-canonicals occupy the other rings, which makes sense if something this crazy actually occurred. So I was really pretty comfortable with that aspect of it. I was really looking at, I spent probably a good 6 months just trying to overcome my bias against the supernatural. Really, it was really probably what it came down to more than anything else.
You know, what's really interesting to me is actually reading the Gospel of Judas. I did that with a colleague. We read the 13 papyrus pages in my office, and at the end of that experiment, we were on the floor laughing. I mean, it honestly, the difference between the Gospel of Judas and the Gospel of John is self-evident when you compare them, when you read one after the other. I want to say one thing real quickly about your books, and that is anyone listening into the podcast, any one of these books available for those who support the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute, you can check them out on the web, equip.org, or write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. I also want to ask you about some of the articles you have written. I've been reading a lot of your articles, one in Town Hall, No GQ, the Bible is not racist, it is not sexist, or boring. It's neither racist nor sexist, and it's certainly not boring. I found that to be an exquisite article. I had actually read the original GQ article, and I love your rebuttal.
Well, this has been a great joy, right? I mean, there's a part of me that just loves cultural commentary, and here's the trick, right? I mean, look, you know that our, and you've been good at this, is that we've tried our best. We'll answer questions. Questions come up, I want to answer the question. But at the same time, I know that I want to bring people along to a Christian worldview, and I realize that if there's a particular political issue that I wish we all agreed on, that rather than camp on that political issue I wish we all agree on, I would rather camp on, is the Bible true, and should we take it seriously? Those two things, I think, are the cause of all the division at the other side about politics or cultural issues or sexuality or whatever it may be. I think it's because either, one, we don't think the Bible is true, so forget about it, or we think it's true, but we take things out of context, we cherry-pick what we like, we don't take it seriously enough to develop a hermeneutic that would help us to actually understand what the Bible is teaching us. So it's because we either don't believe it's true or we don't take it seriously that we end up disagreeing with each other over here. I think if we took it seriously and we thought it was true, that we would agree on 95% of everything, because the Bible's clear on 95% of everything. So I think we would agree on all kinds of things. So rather than camp over on where we disagree and say, we should agree, da-da-da-da-da, I camp on, let's take a look at the Scripture. Do we have good reason to believe it's true and that we should take it seriously? And if we do, I'll let the other stuff fall where it may. And I try not, although I submit articles across the spectrum. I have submitted articles to CNN. I've also submitted articles to Fox News. So wherever the people fall on this spectrum, I've submitted articles to both sides. Now, where they publish, that's not up to me. And so they end up publishing in different locations. But I try to take a very middle-of-the-road approach that elevates the role of Scripture, that elevates the role of the value of the Bible, and then let the other kind of issues fall where they may. That's why the issue of police and race. Listen, that's where we started this conversation. We have divided because one side says all cops are dirty, when in fact it's an incredibly small percentage. On the other side, people have said, oh, really? All African Americans are criminals. When if you look at the numbers on that side, it's incredibly small. So we've got, you're going to judge a small group, a group on the basis of 5% or less of their activity, and both sides do this. On one side, we say, well, you're all like this. On the other side, we say, well, you're all like that. This is one of those things we're going to have to leave behind at the edge in order to cross the bridge. We need an accurate view of each group. And I've done the research to see what the numbers really are. And we call this nut picking, when you take the nut in the group over there and you say all Christians are like that nutty group of Christians. are all whatever, Republicans are all Democrats are like the nuttiest version we can find. We're just nutpicking. Well, it turns out both sides nutpick a lot. And we're going to have to stop nutpicking if we're going to cross the bridge. So I think a lot for me has been about, I love writing about those issues. I love writing on these different sources. I don't pick where they get posted. I actually will start and send them out to everyone, and then one or two will come back and say they're interested. But a lot of this just comes down to trying to elevate the role of Scripture, because I think it teaches us something about race. You know, according to Scripture, there's a lot of people of color in Scripture that you don't even know are of color because their color is never mentioned. I made a list of all those people. Because God doesn't care about your color. He cares about not what's on the outside. He cares on the matters of the heart. So there is no white race, you know, black race, brown race, red race, yellow race to God. There's only one race, the human race. And I think our solutions for the problems we have with race in our country, the one greatest solution offered is the gospel of Jesus Christ. The problem is that we're in a culture where that's becoming less and less allowable in public discourse. So the one thing that would solve the problem is the one thing we can't talk about. And that's where we're going to have a problem going forward. So I think that whatever I can do to write about topics in a public forum that bring us back to the Scripture, that's I feel like I'm called to do.
I like the fact that you mentioned hermeneutics. I agree with you. A lot of what is going on is hermeneutical. People, on the one hand, in the apologetics community are teaching that the Bible is divine as opposed to being merely human in origin. And that is manifestly true, and it ought to be taught. But I think it's equally important to teach people how to read literature of any kind. Most specifically, how to read the Bible in the sense in which it is intended. Many of the criticisms of the Bible are simply a function of not knowing how to read properly.
Now, you're by the way, when we say we're talking about hermeneutics, we have probably lost a lot of them. I think the people who listen to your podcast.
Hey, you used the term. I was just copying
you. I know. But I think that, you know, the people in your podcast world that you've raised
sure.
us up to have a better understanding of what these things mean. But I think if we went to the church in general and said, today's topic is going to be about hermeneutics, people would go, can I leave? Is there a way I can get out of here without being seen? Because I don't want to sit through this. Okay.
Yeah.
And I think that that's probably, you know, where we're at, is that we have a church that's not maybe as thoughtful about these kinds of things. But this is the reality of it, is that if we don't understand how to interpret and how to read, and look, I'm okay if in the end we argue about how this passage should be interpreted based on a hermeneutic. Okay, great. Let's argue about it. At least we're having the discussion, right? Because that means that we're still not always going to agree. But I think we'll agree about a lot more, right? Because I know people who, and also I think that both sides are taking it seriously. They may just have a hermeneutic principle in place that I might disagree with personally. And I might make a case for why I disagree with that, but they'll make a case for why they think I'm wrong and they're right. But at least we're in the right ballpark, that we know where the problem lies, and we are going to hash it out. And that's the problem I think I see, is that not a lot of us even know what the ballpark is. So I think it's up to us now to make the case for how it is we ought to, you know, some things are going to be historical narrative, need to be treated a certain way, but some things are more poetic in their nature, need to be treated. Now, what is what? That's where the argument is. But the idea that I don't take the Bible literally. I take it based on what I think the author intended to say. And that doesn't mean literal. If that was literal, then all the Psalms are going to describe God with wings or with hands or what all. You're getting crazy theology, as you wrote about so well, you know, 25 years ago. That kind of crazy theology comes from a poor hermeneutic. Well, okay. So I think that for us, we now have to kind of help our young people. And by the way, hermeneutics will help answer some of the biggest objections that young people have to Scripture anyway. It's because somebody has read this in a way that is never intended to be read, a certain passage, or they miss the context of the first century or the context of several centuries in the past or several millennia in the past, where the context is so different that it had a different meaning in that context. So I think that those are the things we have to kind of work with young people. And that's, by the way, that's a lot more work than simply cracking open your Bible and telling a story.
Yeah.
And that's why I think for the most part people aren't as good at it. It's much more labor-intensive.
Sure. I mean, it's a science in that rules apply. It's an art in that the more you apply the rules, the better you get at it. I want to do a couple of quick hits here because I was so fascinated by some of the blogs and articles that you've written. One, the three things I wish someone had the guts to tell me when I graduated from college. Surprisingly, so many young people listen to the Hank Unplugged podcast, and I thought, I got to get this in because this is axiomatic to the rest of their lives.
Yeah, and I started teaching this, and I think sometimes people probably wonder. I mean, some of the students, I don't know if they kind of wonder why I would bring this stuff up. But a lot of us teach at a Summit Worldview Conference in Colorado Springs and Manitou Springs, but we're always in the context of young people and trying to help them make decisions. And I started to realize early on that there are several trajectory decisions. The kinds of decisions, you know, if you're launching a rocket from Earth to the moon and you make a 2-degree course error, but you're only a mile away from the moon, you'll still land on the moon. But if you make that same 2-degree course error a mile from Earth, you'll miss the moon by several thousand miles. And so it turns out that these trajectory decisions are those that you make early in life that affect your whole life, because if you're 2 degrees wrong, you're not close to the end. You're close to the beginning. If I buy a car that's a bad choice and it's going to require a lot of repair, well, I can afford that now in my 50s. I could not afford that in my 20s. If I'd have bought that car back then, the decision even about what car to buy is more critical when you're young than it is when you're old, when you can afford to make mistakes. Well, it turns out there are, I think, two or three real important worldview and trajectory decisions that young people have to make. The first is, you know, picking the right worldview. Understand, like you said, origins matters. If we pick a worldview that describes our origins in one way, it determines our own value, our own sense of purpose, how we treat others in the world. So picking the right worldview is something I think you should do very early. I think most of the kids I talk to, by the way, when you ask them, what are the most critical decisions you're going to make between, let's say, 18 and 25, almost all of them say college. What college am I going to go to? Or career? What career should I get involved in? I mean, that's like the top answers. They never think about these three trajectory decisions. It's always about work. And I think, no, it's about worldview, number one. Two, this is one that's most controversial, but it's true. It's about choosing the right spouse. Sorry, it just is. You know, I'm in a field of law enforcement. We are notoriously known as being married, you know, 5 or 6 times before we finish our careers. It's a mess. But choosing the right spouse is all. And you can pick the right education and career, but have the wrong spouse, and guess what? You're going to be miserable most of your life, and you'll probably be divorced a couple times, and all that income you made from that career you were so worried about, you're going to give away in alimony. I mean, think about it. Or you could have a job that's not all that great, not that you're not that excited about, but you are married to the love of your life. Every day is like a honeymoon. It's about choice of spouse. That makes the difference. And there's tons of studies that show that this makes a difference in terms of the health of people who are married relative to the health of those who are not happily married. And the final thing is mission. You know, what is it that I don't care about money. I grew up, my parents divorced really early. I was just my mom and I growing up, and she's never made more than, you know, $18,000 to $20,000 a year even to this day, and she's doing hair for a living, and we were just dirt poor growing up. And for me, it was not about money. I can be very happy on with very little, and my wife is the same way. To me, it's always been about, what's the purpose? What am I here for? What is God calling me to do? So it wasn't hard to leave architecture to come to law enforcement, even though I knew it'd be a dramatic pay cut, because I wanted something that felt like it was a calling, and I wasn't a Christian, but I knew that there was something noble. And you know, we talked about this before. When we talked about law enforcement. You know, this thing that every cop struggles with in every point of crisis is, okay, I'm called to sacrifice all of it, to sacrifice it all, to do the right thing, to support my community, to protect my community. But I also have kids I'd like to see tonight, and I'm struggling between this split second decision about force and the use of force, knowing that I may just have to die in order to do the right thing today. But, man, I'd sure like to see my kids tonight. And what compels us as police officers to go into every shift with the goal of getting home at the end of the day, but knowing that we may not, is because we never saw it as a matter of money. We never saw it as anything other than calling. And you might have to sacrifice it all for a call. And you don't want to sacrifice it all if it's just for a few dollars. And so choosing the right mission, the thing that you would die for. You know, I told my kids, you don't marry that person you can live with. You marry the one you can't live without. You don't choose that career because it pays well, because at some point you'll be bored to tears. You choose the one that you would do for free, because then you'll never work a day in your life. You're basically just playing. You're doing the thing you would do for free. And that's really what I think those three things, worldview, spouse, and mission, are the three trajectory decisions that I want my own kids, because they're all, you know, grown now. They're all, you know, 21 to 30. And I want my own kids, but I also want the high schoolers that I'm working with at Summit or anywhere else to make those decisions a priority.
I was thinking with respect to that third point, my dad used to always say to me, your work ought to be your play, which is precisely what you just said. One more article, and that is sort of related to what you just said with respect to officers being willing to give up their life. But you wrote an article about the shifts behind shootings, and you're talking about mass school shootings. What changed? What accounts for these mass school shootings?
Yeah, that's something that, and people would argue that there really aren't any more school shootings than there have ever been, but certainly the attention has shifted toward the shootings we do have. And I do think there is an increase in the kind, I see a kind of a textural increase, a transformation in culture. And I'm just trying to put my hands around it as a cop and my hands around it as a thinker. You know, what is changing? And I think there are several things that change it. I think, number one, we all know that glowing rectangle at the end of our arms, the social media access we have, is not helping us. Most of the people who are involved in these school shootings will at some point, they'll tell us, or their family members will tell us, how they were criticized or ridiculed or bullied or whatever. Now, look, we've always had bullying. I'm not somebody who... I'm a cop, and we're constantly going to be spoken poorly about, and we're going to be in situations where we're going to get bullied verbally by people, and we just can't just flip out and lose your control. I'm all for learning how to be bullied, okay? But think about it. When I was, 10, if someone at the schoolyard was going to bully me, I could go home, and then the bullying stopped. I could find a way to get away from the bully. And the reality of it is that the young people don't have that option anymore, because that thing is sitting on their nightstand. It's their phone. Or it's someone's social media on an iPad, or it's someplace where the bullying continues 24/7. It's raised. I think we have also, lowered our tolerance for bullying in this culture. We talk about a snowflake culture. I'm not sure it's as bad as that, but I do know that there's a certain masculine toughness that is in law enforcement that probably has protected me a little bit, and hopefully has protected my kids a little bit. The second thing I think I would see is a dependency on prescription meds. Now, I don't mean to say... If you look at all the shootings and you actually research what kinds of prescription meds each shooter is taking, there's no consistency in this, okay? So that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying, oh, hey, all these shooters are all doped out on prescription meds. What I'm saying is something more subtle, and that is that as a culture, we have voluntarily relinquished our parental duty to correct our kids. It used to be if you had a kid who was hyperactive and maybe a little bit, squirrely, we had different ways of dealing with that in 1960 than we do in 2018. We are far more likely to say, well, I don't need to have any parental skill here. I can just medicate this issue, than we would have been 35 years ago when there wasn't really a medication we could give a kid. So we have kind of assigned some of our responsibility as parents to technology and to medicine. And to the degree that we have done that, I think we have less interaction with our kids in terms of guiding and disciplining our kids to know how to represent the family name well, or how to just deal with issues in their own life. You know, it used to be if you were squirrely in church, or squirrely in a setting where you weren't supposed to be squirrely, your parents would make sure you stopped doing that, okay? I'm in planes all the time now, and we seem to have a less of a desire to actually discipline our kids. I don't mean spank them. I'm talking about just to at least tell them, I've got no tolerance for that. I'm going to take you off the plane right now. I'm going to take you into the bathroom, and we're going to have a timeout. Whatever it's going to take for you to discipline your kids. I think we've given away some of that to our technology and prescription medicine. I think also we have an increase in single-family households. I mean, look, the one thing I noticed working gangs, I worked gangs for 2 years in South Central Los Angeles. The one thing I noticed was that all of my gangsters, they did not share a common racial identity. They didn't share a common socioeconomic identity. They didn't even share a common regional identity. They shared one thing in common, and that was lack of dad. That was an eye-opener for me, because I worked Korean gangsters. The only reason why they lacked dad is that dad was a workaholic who never came home. And they were living in very nice homes with very nice houses and getting good grades, but they were still involved in gang activity because dad wasn't home to guide them. I think that we are seeing the percentage of kids under the age of 18 increase, and it is increasing. A single parent now, a single parent setting, has increased dramatically. And all the data is out there to show that. Regardless of why that's happening, it doesn't matter. To me, what it means is that you look at statistically, kids that are raised in two, and this is the formula, two biological parents in a low-conflict setting. That is the formula for success. Every survey done says that kids who are raised by two biological parents in a low-conflict setting, they excel. And so if you break that in any way, and I've adopted two kids, I'm not their biological parents. It's better than it would be where they were, but the best thing for kids, two biologicals, low-conflict setting, as we move away from that model, expect things to break down. And the last thing, I think, is just this idea of Christian values. You know, if nothing else, Christian values teach us to delay gratification, right? I mean, that's at least that. And that foundation has shifted. And I think that we're far more likely, like you said about oranges, if we are not designed in the image of a creator God, then we're no different than any other animal that's evolved to this point. And when a mouse bothers you in your house, you have no problem putting in a mouse trap. And you have no problem then getting rid of the human that's bothering you too, if in fact there's nothing special about humans. I mean, there's lots of reasons why my dad loves the Judeo-Christian worldview that has grounded this country, even though he's not a believer. He was a cop. And he would far rather live in a world that is governed by this kind of restraint than in a world that has no restraint. And as we move away from the teaching of Scripture, the number of people who reject Christianity increases by about 1% a year, then expect us to shift away from the behaviors that are taught in Scripture. That really shouldn't surprise us. And that's where I think it's those four things, increase in social media, the dependency on prescription meds, single-parent households, and finally the decline of traditional Christian values. Those are the things I think that contribute to this problem.
Well, I tell you, I could talk to you forever. You know, you're a guy that's not just cursing the darkness, you're building a lighthouse in the midst of the gathering storm, and if I could take any credit for it, I would say I'm very, very proud of you.
No, you are my, you have spiritual fathers and parents that are you can go back and you can say, if not for that guy, I might be in a different place. And that really is the role you played for me early on. You can ask my wife. I mean, I was such a, I remember getting transferred out of the back room. We call it the back room under a cover position. And I was transferred into robbery homicide, and I realized I would not be at a radio. And if I remember in those days, there wasn't podcasts. There wasn't another way to catch the show. So I was like, oh, man. Good news is I'm getting promoted into detectives. Bad news is I'm going to be unable to listen to the radio. So, I mean, there is some value. So just know you had a role in this, for sure.
Well, thank you. That means the world to me. And your books are phenomenal. I just pray that God will richly bless you and continue to use you. I'm just so grateful for people like you being out there and being mentors to a new generation of apologists. And I want to say one more thing as we close this podcast. The books, as I mentioned earlier, available. Check them out on the web at equip.org. You may want to start with God's Crime Scene. If you haven't read any of the books, you'll get the picture. You'll want to get the other books. But those books available for those who support the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute, check it out on the web at equip.org or write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. And another quick reminder, and that is go to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating. If you can't give this a 5-star rating, I don't know what you can give a 5-star rating. J. Warner Wallace, absolutely phenomenal. We're out of time for this Hank Unplugged podcast, but look forward to seeing you on future podcasts. So long for now.